Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a beauty pageant here in 2020. That might be our second beauty pageant, not sure.
Yeah, I think so.
Happy Texas. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Isco. I feel like Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Drop Dead Gorgeous. We've had a few beauty pageant movies this year.
We have had a few beauty pageant movies.
And with us today to talk about Flawless is the flawless Matthew D'Ambrosio, writer well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, that is the best way to be introduced. Matthew D'Ambrosio.
Yes, flawless, like the adjective was intended, not like the movie we're about to discuss.
Exactly.
Matt is a writer. He wrote on Vampire Diaries and Witcher, currently on Witcher. And he's a return guest. He talked about teaching Mrs. Tingle before, and I think this is in the running for
I think this movie's
I'm back to talk about a bad movie.
Can we say that this movie's worse than Teaching Mrs. Tingle, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Teaching Mrs. Tingle was bad. Don't discount it. It was pretty terrible.
But I still had fun with Teaching Mrs. Tingle. I had no fun with this movie.
No.
I mean, I did. I had some fun. I had there was 10% fun.
Yeah. I'll say this. I was excited about Teaching Mrs. Tingle because of the, the genre that it exists in, right? Like, it's trying to kind of have fun. Yeah. It's a failure, but it at least was trying to, have a little bit of fun. This movie's it's tough. There's a lot here to unpack.
Which I feel like is also the problem. there was so much going on in this movie.
That is a big problem with the movie.
It really feels like, I'm sure we've all heard the terminology of a kitchen sink movie, but it really feels like Joel Schumacher, and we need to talk Joel Schumacher, obviously, on a macro level. But, at this point in his career, this is sort of probably his last. I don't want to say that this might be a blank check movie, if I'm being completely honest, to some degree, because he's still got some clout. He can get movies made. I was surprised on some level to do a little bit of a deep dive into how many films he had written prior to this, because he's actually got a pretty deep bench of movies that he wrote. This isn't this I guess what I'm getting at here is this feels like a first script to me, but it's not, because this guy's written a bunch of scripts before it.
It felt like a movie that was written in a weekend.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like, he wrote the draft, and then everyone's like, you're Joel Schumacher, you can write and direct it, of course.
Yeah.
But then it's like, nothing got edited out of it, and so there are so many storylines that just go nowhere that you're like, what? Why is Rory Kinnear, right? Like, why is he playing guitar and singing about this girl? And that's like all he does in the movie.
Yeah.
The scene that really jumps out at me.
Coltrane, right?
Cochran, I believe is
Cochran. Right.
Yeah.
Rory Kinnear is. Yeah.
Well, we're both, you know.
The scene that really stuck out like a sore thumb to me was the scene with the gay Republicans, where they have that meeting with all those gay Republicans. To what end? I'm still not sure. I don't know why they sat down with them.
And it's such a weird scene, because it's like, again, it's something that just goes nowhere.
Nowhere.
It's like, it felt like Joel Schumacher was like, I hate log cabin Republicans and I'm just going to talk about it. And it's like, okay, but like, to what end? Like, why? Like, why is this happening? It's also like, I have so many things to say.
Here's my fundamental
problem with the movie is that it's called Flawless, but it's about Robert De Niro. Like, we don't even get to see the flawless beauty pageant. We see the end of it.
The end of it.
You see the sign.
Yeah, you see the sign. You see, like, a couple of drag queens, one of which doing a very, very bad, politically incorrect song.
Mm-hmm.
It's a...
Yeah.
So, it's really a terrible movie. It's only a margin... In the annals of trans movies,
yes,
it's only marginally dangerous, which is, you know, good. I think it's not the most dangerous trans movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It does perpetuate a lot of negative stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Not as bad as other movies I've seen. It does cast a cis actor to play a trans leading man trans leading woman in this case, which is rife with problems. But again, something that happened all the time in 1999. So, you know, it was kind of baked into a movie about the culture at that point. The trans character in this movie is essentially a trans version of a magical Negro. Character is essentially, you know, a beaten woman who can only find love in an abusive relationship.
Romantic love. I mean, in theory, she finds something.
Romantic love is what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah, yeah.
That's,
no, that's, no, I know.
You know, and that is, I think, you know, kind of one of the big fears. I lost my train of thought, but basically the whole point is, like, it's a total mess, and it's a hard thing to criticize as a cis person, as a cis straight person, because it comes from a noted, somewhat flamboyant, openly gay man, a person who's kind of a hero in the gay community to some extent. So it's easy for me in 2020 to say I'm, you know, this woke white guy, and I know trans culture better than you, Joel Schumacher.
Yeah.
But I don't, and I don't understand it. So it's like, you know, to some extent, and Matthew, I'm sure you could speak to this to some extent, but we don't have a trans person on the show. We are going to be quoting a lot from something Emily Vandewerf wrote, our friend who's been on the podcast a lot.
Who I texted with the other day for an even more current perspective on it to some degree.
But
yeah, because I was like reading her review of it, and it's like I do see that Philip Seymour Hoffman did bring something to the role. It's like he does better in the role of this trans woman than I think the movie deserves. And I think Emily made the same point too. And it's just like, it's like, that's the thing. It's like 10% of the movie to me is like, if you could just make this, like, there, you had all the ingredients and it just was mishandled at every step of the way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this film, has the best of intentions. Now, you know what they say, that the road paved to hell is the best of intentions. So does
Green Book, which this movie is a lot like to me.
And I see that. I'm not writing for this movie. You know, well, obviously I'll read some of Emily's thoughts and Roger Ebert's 3 out of 4 star review of this film. You know, I think that you know, it seemed like Joel Schumacher was trying to do too much. And I think by trying to do too much, he just sort of it's spread too thin in a bunch of different areas. The script is you know, the script is a mess in terms of injecting all sorts of weird crime drama into this story in order to give it some sort of sense of energy or adrenaline, which is obviously misguided. You know, it's not a good movie. I'm not riding for it, but I do think that, you know, this isn't an evil movie, I guess is what I'm getting at. I don't think that there are much darker, more terrible movies with worse intentions in terms of depictions of any number of different types of people. This movie is flawed.
It is not flawless.
It is not flawless.
So I filibustered a little bit. Matt, what do you think of the movie? You said you had so much to talk about. So what do you
what
do you want to unpack here?
There's just – yeah. Well, first of all, like – I mean, God, where do we even start? It's like the amount of times I was like joking with my boyfriend where it's like, what if I wrote the musical version of this about like Robert De Niro being friends with like a trans woman who like teaches him how to talk again after a stroke. And it's like that funny version of like, and then it's like his joke was like, how many times is Robert De Niro going to say faggot? Like, you should have a song that's all that. And it's like, it was one of those things, like the first, like one of the first lines of dialogue in the movie, it feels like, is just like, yep. I mean, I wish I had kept count. It felt like it was more than 40 times that Robert De Niro and his friends say it.
Easily.
Yeah. And it's just like, at first I was like, okay, well, Joel Schumacher wrote this, so am I giving him a pass? But as the movie went on, I was just like, no, you know what? I'm not. I just can't. And it gets to so many parts where I'm just like, the friendships between Philip Seymour Hoffman and all of like those, like the drag queens and stuff. It's like, literally you have the original Angel from Rent in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's like you reduce that character to just lusting over a straight person in a way that's like, oh man, like you had everything you could have needed. And then it's all like wrapped around this stupid like crime plot that is so boring. And they're just like trying to find their money.
It's awful.
And it's like, who cares? Like, oh cool, this guy's getting awful. This guy's getting beat up and they push over his motorcycle. I could not give less of a shit. And it's just like so many scenes like that, where did it just go nowhere?
Now, Green Book has the big problem with Green Book is that it's, you know, to me for a million, there are a lot of problems with Green Book, but Green Book came out in 2018. Correct. When everybody knew better. Right? When everybody knew better, you know, you don't show this narrative from one person's point of view, from the white person's point of view. So again, it's easy to look at Flawless through the lens of 2020 and say it fucked up, but it does make for a worse movie to be riding with De Niro the entire time. It assumes that the audience shares his points of view about gay people and about trans people. Which they might, but like, the thing is like, I'm not so excited to redeem those people anyway. If you go into that movie with those attitudes, Philip Seymour Hoffman singing, you know, Shirley, Shirley, Bo Burley is not going to change your mind. And particularly like Phil and I have a disagreement about Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance. I didn't like it. I felt. And this is just disagreement. This is, I think, just a very classic, like, agree to disagree. I felt like he was embarrassed by some of the lines that he said. And some of the lines are pretty clever, or at least camp clever on paper. The kind of things that if a person thought of it to say it, I think they'd be kind of proud of themselves. And he swallows a lot of those lines. And I think he swallows a lot of his performance, particularly when he is not. He is more out in the real world than he is in his apartment. And that just felt a little muted to me. And of course, you know, trans contains multitudes, but the words that were coming out of his mouth, by that I mean Philip Seymour Hoffman, did not match the tone in which he delivered those lines. And that's kind of what bugged me.
Well, I hear that. I guess the best way for me to sort of say what I liked about his performance was not the flamboyant qualities of it. What I liked about his performance was actually the smaller, quieter moments, the moments where it felt like Philip Seymour Hoffman was doing the work and digging deep and trying to find, you know, the soul of this person. That to me resonated to some degree. Again, I'm not recommending this film. I don't think this is a good movie, but if there's a bright spot in this film, I think it's his performance. I think that it was probably his biggest movie role up until this point.
That's true.
You know, it was and it did feel like it got him, you know, it got him a Screen Actors Guild nomination, for what that's worth. You know,
nothing
is worth.
Sorry, SAG. We still love you.
Be that as it may, I thought that, you know, let me just quickly read a little bit of Emily Vanderwerf's AV Club review back from 2014. She said, Joel Schumacher wrote and directed Flawless, and to modern eyes, more aware of LGBT issues, the film's handling of Rusty will seem like a weird mishmash of various types and tropes popular at the time. For one thing, Schumacher clumsily conflates the drag queen scene with trans women and vice versa. But the film attracted the most award success Hoffman had seen to date. He could have made Rusty a flamboyant cliche, but he chose whenever possible to dig deeper, to figure out how it might be to long so deeply to become oneself, but be struck without economic options to make the transition. Hoffman's work is quiet, moving, and humanistic, and it provides the film with a core Schumacher doesn't remotely earn. No matter, this is another movie worth seeing almost entirely for the Titanic work Hoffman does near its center. I for the most part, I agree with that. I mean, I think that that's probably where I land on this thing, which is it's not a good movie. If there's anything good to come from it, it is his performance. I also just want to quickly read a text that Emily and I had the other day about this. She said, "My general take on cis actors playing trans roles is they can never wholly capture transness, but they can come close if they do the work. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman did the work." So
how do you feel? How do you feel after watching Disclosure about that?
I mean, I
never again, right? Like never again.
I don't disagree. And I'm not, again, like I'm not sitting here necessarily defending him portraying Rusty in this movie.
I think
that moving forward, I think we absolutely should do our part to make sure that the trans people portray trans characters. But all that being said, this film exists and we're here to talk about this film for all intents and purposes. So that's kind of where I land on this thing. And it's kind of the only hill I would be willing to die on in the discussion of this film, because I think everything else is pretty much dreck and bad. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman, I miss him. He's great. I wish that we got to have more work from him. And to your point, Kenny, when we were texting the other day, I wish that him and Robert De Niro worked together in a better movie.
Yeah, because, I mean, just quickly, De Niro's hidden under the effects of the stroke, and it's brutal to see my favorite actor have to, you know, talk through the side of his mouth and not be able to emote. But Schumacher, so here's, you know, woke white straight guy from 2020, makes a couple of really, really kind of weird choices that are bad. One is the Dog Day Afternoon of the plot in 1999. Correct. The idea that the only thing that a trans person would care about is getting a sex change operation or gender reassignment operation. So that's not great. Second is the conflation of drag queen culture and trans culture, which I thought this was a drag queen movie. I didn't realize it was a trans movie. And we could talk about, I thought this fell in the Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Tu Wong Fu, Cabaret, you know, kind of school of
Birdcage.
Yeah. School of drag queen movies.
So did I, by the way. I didn't know this was a trans movie either.
I don't think it does discern the difference between the two, which are, it's just wildly different. And that's borne out by a line that Philip Seymour Hoffman has near the end of the movie, which undercuts the entire fucking character when he says to De Niro, "I'm more man than you'll ever be and more woman than you'll ever get." Come on. Like, that to me is, someone didn't do their homework, right? There was probably not a single trans person on set. So, or maybe there was, and they just didn't feel like they were, you know, empowered to speak up. But
I couldn't agree with you more that line encapsulates all of the problems with this movie.
I yelled. I was like, come on.
That's it.
But it's like that sort of thing where it's like, it feels like Joel Schumacher saw The Birdcage in 96 and thought, I can do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going to make it grittier. And it's like, one of my biggest problems with the movie, besides the content being awful and like mishandled, is just that it's like the tone is just like, is it supposed to be funny? Is it supposed to be serious?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it doesn't know what it wants to be. And the other thing about it is like, you know, there still is a lot of like anti-trans sentiment in the gay community. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, for a white gay man to write this, a white cis gay man to write this movie, and just like, and have lines like what you just said, Kenny, it's just like, you don't understand. Yeah. Like, you, did you even ask like a trans person how they would feel about this? Because that's not, I don't think, and like, I'm not going to pretend I can speak for a trans person, but like, even as a human, he's hearing that line is like, that doesn't compute with that experience.
So I couldn't agree with you more. And I feel like we need to just quickly kind of go through the ramp up of Schumacher's career into this film, because I do think that it really gives, as I was looking at this, at his filmography while watching this film, because it really helped me sort of understand how he got here. So he wrote a bunch of stuff. He wrote a movie called DC Cab with Mr. T back in the 80s. He wrote The Wiz, the screenplay to the movie The Wiz. And then he gets St. Elmo's Fire, and that's obviously a very big deal. That really kind of puts him on the map. He does St. Elmo's Fire. He does The Lost Boys in 87. Then he does Cousins with Ted Danson, which I never saw. Then he does Flatliners in 1990, Dying Young in 91, Falling Down in 93, The Client in 94, then it's Batman Forever in 95, and then Time to Kill in 96, Batman and Robin in 97, and then 8mm and Flawless in 99. This is a guy who is really cresting. I mean, this is him at kind of the peak of his powers, even if Batman and Robin was a big flop and a big disaster.
It's still great. It's still good.
That's amazing.
For you.
It's not a good movie, but I love it.
That I agree with.
It's metal, Batman.
All time.
but I do think that 8mm and Flawless and then Tigerland is Joel Schumacher trying to get gritty. It's him thinking, I can do gritty. I can get into the, you know, into the tough stuff. And he can't. Like, that's just not his lane.
Yeah, well, but Falling Down is the tough stuff.
That's true.
And Falling Down.
Falling Down's a good movie.
It's the best movie. So,
and like 8mm 2 is also like, it's also a good movie. It's just the subject matter is hard. But this was just not it.
He probably shouldn't have used the same production designer, lighting designer, set. Like, they look exactly the same.
And turned over to the sets.
I know. They just went right into another. Y'all come with me.
In 12 hours, they got to get Nicolas Cage on the set.
Yeah, they just cross. Yeah, they just cross-boarded the two movies.
Yeah, they just double-boarded it. Yeah.
Like, that's what it felt like. I hated the way Flawless looked. I couldn't believe it. It made the experience. Now, like, to some extent, there is a movie in a trans character living this impoverished life, which is essentially what he was doing.
And I think that's what frustrates me so much, is that there is such a kernel to that I'm like, I would want to see that. Even like, and not maybe not necessarily as homophobic, but it's like, you know, a conservative-ish Robert De Niro learning to be cool with like queer trans people. Like, I could like that movie. And like I said, the ingredients are there, where it's like, you almost had it. Well, you didn't almost have it, because like, you obviously didn't get there. But it was just like, there were so many moments where you're just like, okay, cool. Like, this partnering could be great. And it's just not.
But it's interesting, because as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, what's the best version of this movie? And there is a good version of this movie. I do believe in a better writer's hands, a better director's hands. It's part of the problem, I think, is, to Kenny, your point on the green book of it all, which is, when a studio gets involved in a movie like this, to some degree or another, you start to feel, you know, the universality of it, this desire of trying to make it a hit, this desire of trying to make it into something big and accessible to a lot of people. And that lack of specificity leads you to, you know, your bullshit with this drug money and you know, all of this nonsense, that just, this movie needs to be a small character piece between two people from two very different worlds finding some sort of commonality. But what we're left with is just a mishmash, like the shaky camera shit and the just all of it. It's very formless. Like, it's a mess. Yeah.
What's a little annoying about it is The Birdcage was such a massive hit and such a massive cultural moment. And I think the lesson people might have taken away from that, and from movies like Mrs. Doubtfire, and from other movies where you had these, you know, famous actors playing drag as big and body, was, you go big and body when you do that. And you see it in, you know, Eddie Murphy's done it, Martin Lawrence has done it, and on and on and on. And Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance, though I am not particularly fond of it, it's very muted, right? And I do wonder if the lesson people took away from it was, if you're going to have a femme-presenting male actor, whether it's drag or trans, in your movie, go big, go crazy, because making the rest of the movie crazy, which is what I think he was kind of trying to do, trying to kind of wrap it in this like stupid ass crime bow. It's so bad. Well, I think that, no, it's terrible. And I think that was really, you know, to some extent, what really killed the movie. But I do wonder if at the time the lesson they took away from it was more Big Mama's houses, less, you know, quieter kind of performances. And there is a reason why you didn't see a lot of these kind of performances in mainstream movies, like fucking forever, until like a couple of years ago.
And I think that's like one of the things that, you know, really rubbed me the wrong way with this movie, where, because like, The Birdcage is honestly one of my favorite movies of all time. Like, even from like a young age, before I even knew what gay was, I was like, ooh, me. I'm like Nathan Lane. Like, I like that character.
Yeah.
And so I think that's like with this movie, you know, you look at it, it just feels so hyper masculinized. Like, there's like a lot of toxic masculinity in this movie, in a way that is just so hard to watch and not fun to watch, where it's like, I kept thinking of like, what would be my version of this movie? And it would be Robert De Niro helping like this trans woman with her drag show. Like, that's the movie that I want to see. Because it's like, I keep thinking of like, my favorite part of like The Birdcage is Gene Hackman in drag. Like, it's like,
it's so amazing.
Everything is leading to that moment. He is a ultra conservative. And then in the movie, you see him in the wig and he doesn't know what to do, but he's still like doing it. It's like, I was waiting for like moments like that, but it felt like this movie was so focused on, this is, you know, masculinity. Robert De Niro is a man. And like, it was like transness filtered through that sieve.
It's a weird kind of, it's a weird climax.
It really ideas. Felt.
The weird climax is.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. Okay.
It almost feels like the lesson Robert De Niro learned is that a damsel in distress can also be a trans woman. Like, I you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because he didn't learn much.
You know what this movie actually, now that we've been talking about it, kind of reminds me of, as we talk about it, is As Good As It Gets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit of that sort of a curmudgeon character that we can ultimately, hopefully, come to love, who is forced to have a relationship with a gay character or gay characters, you know, but the difference, of course, is, and the reason that I thought of that is because I think that De Niro being our protagonist is what destroys the movie, because it's the tonal issue, and he's the prism that we have to see it through, and we don't want to see the movie through that guy's eyes. So it's just, to your point, Matt, like, it over-masculinizes the film, and it just creates, like, you almost think, I would have rather the film be from Rusty's perspective, mm-hmm. and that he's forced into the life of this curmudgeonly supporting character. I think that just I just think it's a perspective thing. I think the film's perspective is from the wrong people.
Yeah.
But why does As Good As It Gets work? Because
this doesn't
works really fucking well. And this doesn't.
Yeah.
And
I think you know the characters. It's the characters, like, right? I mean, in As Good As It Gets, like, you know, Jack Nicholson is a curmudgeon, but you know him to such an extent that, not that you get it, but you're along for the ride with it. But, like, when your point of view for this movie is a homophobic ex-cop, like, I don't, from the immediate get-go, it's like, why am I supposed to sympathize with this guy having a stroke?
Yep.
It's like, he has called Philip Seymour Hoffman a faggot like a million times already.
Yeah.
Like, why am I supposed to give a shit that now that, you know, that queer trans person is supposed to take pity on him for not being able to talk anymore?
I think that's the reason too, because in As Good As It Gets, anything Jack Nicholson says to Greg Kinnear's character, as bigoted as it is so clearly coming from a place of sadness and vulnerability. Right, like, he is so destroyed by his OCD that you have to feel some level of empathy for him and hope that he can get better because he's had a hard life. Whereas all I hear about this De Niro character is that he was a hero over and over. You're a hero. Yeah. You're a hero cop. This guy's a hero. He goes to the bar. All the women want him. Like, everything seems pretty fucking good for this guy. He has the stroke trying to save people's lives again. I don't want to see him back on his feet at all. Having a stroke is kind of a good thing for society.
And it's like, it's interesting too, because like in him talking about his life and like talking about that friend who like ran off and disappeared in Asia.
Yeah.
It's like part of me was hoping for, like, did that friend go off to Asia to get gender reassignment surgery?
Because
that'd be,
yeah, that's
that was like, I was like, okay, like, so you have a connection to this. And then the other thing is, like, his other friend seems kind of cool. Like, at first he's a little homophobic, but then he's hanging out with these like queer drag queens and having a good time and not being an asshole about it. And I'm like, where's that movie? Like, that's the character that I feel like I want to see more of.
I think the other reason that how this movie differs from As Good As It Gets, Kenny, to your other, to your question too, is James L. Brooks is not a plot guy. He doesn't give a shit about plot. He cares about story and character. He cares about how those two things fuse together. This movie has too much plot for its own good at times. And Schumacher's just not, I'd say that one of his biggest issues ultimately is that he's always dialing everything up, right? Because he doesn't feel comfortable. Maybe he thinks that our audience will get bored. I don't know what it is, but he's not a guy who's comfortable just letting the movie slow the fuck down and just have two people talk, which is sort of surprising because this film actually has a fair amount of those scenes where these two people have to just sit down and talk and open up to each other. And that's when the movie, if the movie shines at all, it's during those scenes, I think. But that's kind of the thing where it's like he always just needs something happening, you know. And that's, I mean, even look at something like Phone Booth, which is a bizarre movie that I'm shouldn't work at all, which is that the entire fucking thing takes place in a phone booth. It also is a relic of a time when phone booths mattered, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, that was the last phone booth in New York, right? Isn't that the whole thing? That's the conceit of the movie. Like, they obviously
The conceit of the movie?
Yeah, they wrote this movie, and clearly they're like, wait, there are no phone booths anymore. Just make it the last one in New York. I'm serious. It's hysterical.
I know you are. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But again, like, that's the type of thing where I kind of respect Joel Schumacher for being like, fuck it. Yeah, okay. Let's do the phone booth movie. Like, he's a guy that's willing to kind of take these. Rest in peace.
I hated that movie. I know some people love that movie, and it's my kind of movie because I love crazy, stupid fucking swings. I'm crazy about I watched Man on a Ledge because I like a movie about a man on a ledge.
Ledges. It's so weird.
Man on a Ledge is the weirdest movie. Like, every character has a last name that is racially inappropriate for them. Right? Like the black character has a Jewish name. Like the Indian. I'm not kidding.
Ackerman.
Anthony Mackie plays a character whose last name is Ackerman. That's like my dad's attorney is Ackerman. So whatever, Man on a Ledge, not good, a little better than Phone Booth, but some people really like Phone Booth.
Phone Booth was just a movie that like shouldn't have worked and mostly didn't work, but I watched a DVD of it when I worked at a video store because I was like, huh, I wonder if Phone Booth works. Most of the time, most of it doesn't work. But I more than anything, it's an example of the type of filmmaker that Joel Schumacher kind of turned into that maybe he didn't want to, but he became, which was, you know, he could get a movie made, but like his budgets kept shrinking. Near the end of his career, he made a bunch of movies that basically no one saw. I mean, I think the last movie of his that got really any kind of notoriety was his Phantom of the Opera movie, which is
considered very bad.
Yeah, I mean, but also,
to be fair, that musical also.
I was gonna say, like, the musical kind of sucks. Yeah. So, like,
you guys are wrong.
I mean, listen, I saw that coming as a young, not gay person had a Phantom shirt that he wore all the time.
Yeah.
So, like, I know Phantom, and I hate Phantom.
Just to be clear, Kenny, I think Phantom has some bangers. I'm not saying it doesn't have some good songs. I just think that overall, it's not great.
It's okay. I can handle that.
I liked it more than Rent. I'll say that.
Andrew Lloyd Webber. Oh, wow. Andrew Lloyd Webber is generally good for one good song, a musical. This one has like five, so like you
gotta give him credit where credit's due.
It's pretty bad, but it is definitely his best musical. Rent. Okay. Talk to me about how much you hate Rent.
Oh, I just hate it. I hate it so much. I mean, like I hate every single song, and it's like I'm happy that it exists. I am so happy that people love it a lot. I just don't. I think it's so cloying and saccharine and just like treacly, and it's like maybe if I had seen it live when it first premiered I would have a better reaction to it, but it's like everything has been filtered through like secondhand theater kids like in the late 90s to the point where I'm just like I'm tired of singing this fucking Seasons of love song. I hate it so much.
I'll say this. Yeah, go ahead.
No.
I was just gonna say, like, I did see Rent live. There's a handful of songs of Rent's that I like, but I do think, in its own weird way, it has similar problems that Flawless has, which is it's overstuffed, it's trying to do too much, it glosses over big issues. But I also say that, you know, part of it is obviously Larson's narrative, the fact that we lost him so young, and the fact that, you know, his musical was so sort of tightly hewn to his his story gives it a whole sort of other level of so I understand why people love Rent, even if I'm not like the biggest Rent fan. But anyway.
I liked Angel more in this movie than I did in Rent.
Oh,
I'm just kidding. No, I didn't.
All I wanted to say,
I mean, there's no way.
Rent probably sucks. but it doesn't. And Lindsay Ellis, I don't know if you guys have watched Lindsay Ellis on YouTube. Lindsay Ellis just destroys it in one of her video essays, and it made me feel real stupid forever liking it. no, it does. It does probably suck, but I don't know. One Song Glory, that does it for me.
It's a good song. It's a good song.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I like Santa Fe.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kenny and I feel the same way about Rent. There's like a handful of Rent songs that, like, every now and then I'm like, I have a hankering to listen to Rent.
I'm so happy that you guys like it, truly.
I think Rent probably sucks, and I think Rent probably is like intro to gayness for square little straight kids like me and Phil.
And again, I think that's why I can appreciate it, because it's like, right, like, I mean, I grew up in a small town too. And I'm so glad that, you know, those people had Rent. I didn't. I had Rocky Horror Picture Show and, like, gay porn. That was my intro to gayness.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I'm going to read the synopsis of Flawless real quick here for the people who haven't seen it. A former security guard, Walter Koontz, played by Robert De Niro, experiences a severe stroke and must begin physical therapy after leaving the hospital. Part of Walt's recovery program includes regaining his speech by taking singing lessons, and he gets paired with Rusty, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, a vocal instructor and neighbor. Walt, however, is extremely homophobic, and Rusty is flamboyantly gay and awaiting gender assignment surgery. So the two don't have an easy relationship. An easy start to their relationship. This movie was written and directed by Joel Schumacher. It opened on Thanksgiving weekend, November 26th, 1999.
Oh, jeez.
In 11th place against End of Days, which with $2 million, it would go... Yeah, End of Days, great movie. It would go on to make $4.4 million on a $15 million budget. Flawless has 41% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 53% from audiences. I'm going to read a very quick portion of Ebert's 3-4-star review. The plot of Flawless is too busy and sometimes strays from fictional hitherlands. Rusty's posse of drag friends has a way of turning up on cue like the factory workers in Carmen. De Niro is a great technical actor who may have been attracted to this material because of the chance to play a stroke victim. His performance not only gets Walt's symptoms right, but also shows sympathy for the man inside. Hoffman, who played the pathetic man who made dirty phone calls in Happiness, shows he's one of the best new character actors able to take a flamboyant role and find the quiet details in it. Too bad they're stuck in a jumbled plot, but as an odd couple, they work. 3-4 stars is absolutely fucking insane.
Especially, I mean, from what you just read, that does not sound like he even really liked it that much. Why did he give it that many stars?
I mean, listen, Kenny and I can
watching Siskel and Ebert review this movie.
Yep.
I don't remember it being positive reviews. I thought it was a pretty negative review. I also remember being a big Philip Seymour Hoffman fan because Boogie Nights was like kind of my favorite movie.
Sure.
Kind of being excited for him that he has this chance to now be like, you know, above the title. Like, this guy was like 6, 7, 8 people down in every movie he was in. And it was kind of a shame that it was so, I thought it was really poorly received. 41% is a little better than I thought it was. But
yeah, I mean, the other thing too is like, this is an MGM movie. MGM, I mean, listen, MGM's been struggling for 20 years at this point, but this was an MGM movie too. So, you know, this movie shouldn't have been released on Thanksgiving. I think they thought that they maybe had an Oscar nomination chances or something like that for one of them. And they wanted it.
Oh, they definitely did.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the family on Thanksgiving weekend? Just like, let's go to the movies. What's playing? Flawless.
It's a De Niro pick. Yay.
Come on, it's De Niro. And then they show up and they're like, what is this?
What the fuck is this? Yeah. It's, so it's funny you brought up Rent and musicals, because so the cinematography in this movie drove me fucking crazy. But I was like, who shot this thing? And then I looked at this cinematographer's filmography, and he just did the Hamilton.
I saw that too.
So there you go.
What?
He shot a stage production. What Hamilton? You know, not gonna give
what a career trajectory. Jeez.
You know, he's still alive and he's still working.
It's, yeah.
Well, literally speechless.
Yeah, he is.
What do you got, Phil? Phil?
Yeah, I mean, we should walk through the plot a little bit, but there's not a ton of plot here, but there kind of is at the same time. It basically opens with all of this like shaky fucking footage of cross-cutting between Walt and these criminals busting into his apartment building to try to, we can't really tell what they're doing, but it looks like they're either running from somebody or trying to hide something. It's kind of unclear. And then Walt yelling at Rusty for singing in his apartment across the hall. And then they cross cut again between Walt and Rusty as they're getting ready for their day. Like, there's a lot of sort of like these two worlds are about to collide component that if you stripped away the fucking crime stuff would have worked a lot better, because it just gets muddled with all of this. Like, then this criminal hides in someone's apartment and other criminals come for the money, and you just don't really completely understand what's going on. It's odd.
They also do that thing where like they just have a couple of generic looking bad guys of different ethnicities.
Yes.
You know, just on some like Joker crew shit, you know, how like Joker just pulls out whatever bad guy survived killing each other.
Poor Chris Bauer.
One of whom is Chris Bauer was what I was going to say. Who is also, an 8 Mile. I mean, sorry, 8 Millimeter. Yeah.
He was an 8 Millimeter. He's the guy, isn't he? At the end,
yes, he is. He's clearly Schumacher's go-to guy.
Yeah,
and then he went to work on the docks in Baltimore.
Yeah,
and then he got to work in True Blood.
Oh, he was in that.
He's like the sheriff.
Oh, yeah.
What's his name in The Wire?
Frank Zabaka.
Yeah, I love Frank. I love Nicky Zabaka.
Frank Zabaka. I worked at the docks.
Am I the
this is my nephew like Ziggy.
I love Ziggy and I love Nikki.
Yeah. MVPs.
Yeah.
So then we see a bunch of drag queens are trying to go up to Rusty's apartment, and Walt doesn't want to share the elevator with them. You know, just real classy stuff. Stuff cool. to make you like them. Mm-hmm. Things that And then the criminals show back up. There's a gunfight, and Walt tries to say some people. He has a stroke. He wakes up the next day. He's paralyzed partially. He's got facial paralysis and what have you. Kenny, you mentioned that you really didn't like De Niro's performance in this film.
Well, no, I didn't like his performance. I don't really blame him. I think playing a stroke victim is hard and, necessarily restricts your movements.
Yeah.
I really can watch De Niro do almost anything. I absolutely love him. I realized that during 3 hours of The Irishman, but this was not a real attractive De Niro performance to me.
In the cursory research that I did on this film, because I won't surprise you guys, there's not really a lot to dig into. There's not a lot of articles.
Shocking.
On Flawless. People are I don't know, pretending like it didn't exist. But there's a piece of trivia that I saw that said that after reading the script, De Niro's the only thing he had to say to Joel Schumacher is, "When do we start?" And I like that can be couched in either a very positive or a really negative light. It could be like, yeah, let's do it. When do we start? The other is, where's my fucking mark? Like, you're paying me? Great.
Yeah, where's the money? Cool. I'll do it. I have to like talk out of the side of my mouth for 2 hours. Great.
Yeah.
It's interesting because yeah, you really could take it either way. I don't know if he was excited to do this movie or not. I don't know. So then De Niro and Hoffman, they have their first kind of scene together in the laundry room where De Niro just fucking yells all sorts of terrible things at him. And he's like, all right. Like, the other thing, too, is that Rusty, say what you will about his character, but like, he's a glutton for punishment, which certainly seems to fit the mold, or he just genuinely feels bad for this guy and he figures that eventually he'll break through to him. But my God, how many times do you have to be called terrible names by a person to just be like, I'm not going to fucking talk to you anymore?
Bam. Yeah, it was so frustrating too, because it's like, you know, leave him alone. Let him have his stroke. Like, he doesn't want you around. Like, he doesn't deserve your sympathy either. Like, just go win that contest.
I don't really understand it, but it is what it is. Rusty's boyfriend.
I also don't really understand why De Niro lives in that building.
I don't either.
He almost actually makes no sense. I was going to say he almost does it to piss himself off, but that's not really the kind of character he is. And yeah. You never got the whole like, oh, 20 years ago this neighborhood was nothing but cops, and now it's nothing but trash. It never made any sense to me why he would do that. Go be a bigot. I don't want to say where bigots live in Staten Island, but I just don't want to say exactly where.
Oh, I know. It's where my family lives.
In Staten Island? Is that where you're from? Stop it.
No, I have family who does live in Staten Island.
It's huge bigots.
Oh, I don't know if they're huge bigots, but I'm sure they know where they
are. So go to Staten Island. There's a whole island for you guys.
Hey,
you
know?
It's called
over the bridge with your red hat.
Bigot Island. Yeah. What's the bridge? It's the Verrazano Narrows.
The Verrazano Narrows. It's my favorite bridge. It's such a nice bridge.
Yeah.
It goes to such a terrible place.
That's how your mind goes as you go across it. It narrows.
And it costs so much fucking money to cross that bridge.
Why would you want to go to
Staten Island?
Now, I haven't seen The King of Staten Island, which, you know, whatever, might be good, might be bad. The only movie
I saw, it's fine.
The only movie I know that really is set in Staten Island, which is my favorite, is How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Matthew McConaughey's family is allegedly... he's Staten Island born and raised. Matthew McConaughey, they go back to hang out with his Staten Island family. They know all their Staten Island stuff. They're really wonderful people.
Does he have an accent in that movie that's like a New York accent?
No, fucking Southern accent.
It's classic McConaughey. He just sounds like he's from Austin.
But he's supposed to be from New York. He's a huge Knicks fan. Yeah.
Cool. He's a man after your heart, Kenny.
People love that movie. I don't even want to talk shit. People will come after me if I talk shit about that movie.
Speaking of coming after you, Rusty's boyfriend, Sonny, comes after him at this point in the film and just like beats him up and is looking for money. And and again, this is part of what you were saying earlier, Matt, which is that this movie also feels like it was edited within an inch of its life. It's like an hour 45. And there's like a 2 hour version of this film that makes more sense, but they were just like, fuck it. We got like people, you know, like,
thank life God.
It's like life's too short, but his boyfriend shows up and beats him up looking for money. And then he has this scene with Walt where he's like, he's not always like the, like, you know, the beaten, you know,
girlfriend.
It's a very strange thing that it's another thing we didn't need.
It's a trope, and it's a real,
yeah,
it's kind of negative, kind of dangerous trope.
100%.
Really, you know, learn, like, the biggest takeaway, Matt, did you see Disclosure?
Yes.
So the biggest takeaway from Disclosure, or one of them, but was the constant reinforcement of negative stereotypes for it, being trans is not like being Black or Latinx or Asian, in that you do have to decide at some point that you are going to present as your, you know, as the gender you identify with. You have to make that decision. And the constant reinforcement that trans people are not worthy of love and not worthy of jobs and not worthy of respect and not worthy of dignity or even humanity in a lot of places, mm-hmm. is really what I took away from that. And there are so few counterexamples. That's why a movie like Rocky Horror is so powerful to some extent.
Yeah.
You know, or a movie like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, things like that.
Even Tu Wong Fu. It's also just like these movies that it's the lens that you're viewing this from through is more sympathetic.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, Robert De Niro hears that Rusty is trans and the first question is, how can you cut off your dick and balls? And it's like, what the fuck? Like, is that's your first thought? Like, fuck you.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it really perpetuating these negative stereotypes. And frankly, the De Niro line you quoted is also a negative stereotype of like straight cis people, that they're just so obsessed with genitals. Like, that's not necessarily true either. And is also another thing that, like, as soon as I identify as trans, people are going to start asking about my genitals. Like, that's disgusting too. That's a horrible thing to perpetuate. So the idea that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, when she was in a romantic relationship, had to be abused in order to have anybody look at her that way is the kind of thing that keeps people closeted.
Yeah,
I couldn't agree more. You know, as I was watching the Disclosure documentary, that was sort of the thing that hit me, was that whole sequence they do where they're talking about all of the various ways that trans people have been killed on television and in movies, and when you see it all put together like that, I was just like, my God, it's really problematic. Like, it didn't even really occur to me. You know, I've heard and read the Sons of the Lambs argument, you know, and but then when you see all of the sort of crazy trans characters that are serial killers or murderers, and then if they're not that, then they're being murdered by somebody else because of the fact that they're trans. It's all really dangerous and perpetuates this terrible stereotype. This movie, I feel like, truthfully, it doesn't even really talk about the trans experience in any real way. It sort of it dances around it a little bit, but it doesn't really get into it.
You don't have to. Like, that's
no, I know. Like,
it is about that, but like,
yeah,
you don't have to. I don't know. Like, what responsibility do you have?
I think that's what's also so disappointing about this movie, like going into it and seeing the trailer makes it seem like it is a ex cop teaming up with a drag queen. You don't know what that means. It's just like, oh, okay. Like, Philip Seymour Hoffman's playing a drag queen. And then you watch the movie and it's just so dark and tonally off, and Robert De Niro has a stroke and Philip Seymour Hoffman is playing trans and being beaten by her boyfriend. And like, it's the fact that this movie was written and directed by a gay man is like, man, like, dude, like, why did you should have just asked somebody, anybody. Yeah. And it's like, I'm not even saying like Philip Seymour Hoffman shouldn't have been trans, but it's like the way that Joel Schumacher wrote this movie was just so offensive that it's like, you didn't have to do it this way. That's what's so frustrating about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of, we've said this before on this podcast, but I mean, it bears repeating as well. I can't imagine reading this script and saying, here's $15 million. Like, now I understand that perhaps he secured Robert De Niro, and once he had De Niro, perhaps it was I don't know. But I don't understand how a development executive can read this script and not say, like, I think we need another pass. I think we need to clarify some things. I think that some stuff's working, some stuff's not. That's the stuff that really hits me with movies like this. I mean, we've watched bad movies. Kenny and I have watched bad movies. We've talked about bad movies, you know. But there's a bad, stupid action movie, and then there's this, which is trying to be socially conscious to some degree. It is written and directed by a gay man. Like, it seems to think that it's has something positive to put out into the world, but it is just tripping over itself in an attempt to do that.
And that's the thing, too, where it does, it, like I said earlier, it feels like the first draft of a script that no one ever rewrote. Because, like, really, and again, there were just so many plot lines, like Rory Cochran, right?
That's his
name. Rory Cochran, like, playing guitar and singing about his ex-girlfriend and calling her a bitch and all this shit. And you're like, what is, like, why am I seeing this? What? Like, who is this person?
And why is he playing like, there's with the so door many... open in the hallway of his apartment?
Yes, and, yes, yes.
Just, like, so many threads to this movie that just don't go anywhere. And you're like, can you just, like, rewrite this? And, like, I don't know if that would help, but it was just, like, yeah, like so many things that maybe just got cut out through editing. Like, again, thank God it wasn't longer than it needed to be. But it was just like, yeah, I just, it's Kenny, to your point, it just should have been about Rusty. Like, if that should have been our point of view. Like, I didn't need Robert De Niro's point of view in this movie.
Yeah. But then when, you know, the argument with that is, in 1999, they didn't make movies like that, right?
Yeah.
You didn't make it. There wasn't anything. I mean, I might be wrong, but the first time I remember any movie where a trans person was the protagonist, not where a trans person was a supporting character, where they were the protagonist, was Tangerine. And I don't think Tangerine came out until like 2016. And I think Tangerine was shot on iPhones for, you know, under $1 million. So, like,
great movie.
It's a great movie. So, like, to some extent, there is a bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. Mm-hmm. And you do your best with the circumstances. So, like, it's hard for me to just say Philip Seymour Hoffman never should have played the character, which I know no one is saying in any kind of real way. But it is, I don't know. I don't, I, if you get, this is what I'm trying to say. If you get your one shot at telling this type of story, which it seems like Schumacher was going to get, you have to fucking do better. The amount of responsibility you have when you get your shot with $15 million and one of your two protagonists is a trans person, you have to fucking birdcage it.
I think is also so disappointing about the movie is, like, on paper, it's like, okay, a gay man making a movie like this, cool, I'm gonna watch it. And then you see it and you're like, wait, this isn't what it should be. Like, what? You blew it, buddy.
And it's unfair to put that on the one movie. And I understand that too. And this is like, this is what black actors and black directors and black producers have been saying, writers, for years, which is this idea of, like, if I'm making a black show about anything, but anything unusual, right? If I'm making the black show about Kindergarten, it better fucking kill or else we'll never get to do it again. Mm-hmm. And that is a big fucking heavy load, but it also is the reality of, like, this fucked up town that the whites in charge are going to use anything to stay in charge and not have to, you know, diversify the people behind in front of the camera.
I think that there's also, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like I really do find Joel Schumacher a fascinating filmmaker. I really do. I look at his filmography and I think he's got a lot of really interesting films. Some of them I would even say I love. He's certainly got more, swings and misses than he has home runs. But I respect the guy. And I do think he does some really interesting stuff. And I watch this film and it just feels like he didn't ever say no to himself, right? Like, there's, as you said, a million characters in this thing. He was just interested in a bunch of colorful characters just all existing in the same universe. But without any real reason for them to mm-hmm. connect. Like, this isn't Magnolia. I mean, this isn't just like the interconnectedness of life. This is just like, oh, and then there'll be a guy who's like the landlord of the place, and he'll be yeah. up to shady things, but I don't really know what he's up to, but he's up to something. And you're like,
and then his bird dies.
Yeah,
it's what the hell? Monstrous.
So it's one of those things where it feels to me personally like if Batman and Robin had worked, who knows what might have happened, because it seems like there was a massive course correction off of that movie, despite the fact that I agree with you, Matt, that movie doesn't work but is fun. It's his most flamboyant, his most garishly in your face, crazy, candy colored movie. And then he course corrects into 8mm and this. And it feels like he never really gets back to making fun movies again. Everything yeah. he does from there is dark and brooding or an attempt at doing so. And I wish that this film had been what we're kind of talking about it being, which is a movie that wraps its arms around an interesting culture that he clearly has a connection to, rather than making it this somber, weird crime drama that it doesn't need to be.
I think that's what's like so sad about it, like to that point of just like, yeah, he did Batman and Robin and it didn't do as well as he wanted. And he just almost like closeted himself back up and wrapped himself yeah. in a masculinity towel. And it was like, look, I can be gritty and angry. Like, here's a movie about snuff films. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, go too far.
That's great. Here's a movie about snuff films.
It's like, here is Poison Ivy in a gorilla costume doing a dance, intoxicating an entire room of people. And the critics were like, no. And he's like, okay, well, snuff films?
it's like there's something in between those two things, Joel. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing. And I feel like he never comes back. It's just he gets darker and darker.
Batman and Robin is also emblematic of this. Is the one chance to do
most things, really, you know?
Really, yeah. The one chance to do a really over-the-top, campy superhero movie. And sorry, guys, he fucking blew it. That movie's the worst.
But like, it is like the campiest.
There is. I should watch it again. I should watch it all.
You should watch it again.
I've seen it 100 times, but it's the
really.
Yeah, because you watch those movies on Cinemax or HBO over and over. I think I know every fucking line. I mean, let's chill.
When we got our first DVD player that was like the size of like a table back in like the late 90s, it came with Batman and Robin on DVD. Like, they couldn't get rid of DVDs of that movie. Yeah. They're like, here's your $500 DVD player and a copy of a movie nobody wants.
Yeah. Oh.
I feel like that was back in the day when the DVDs were flippers, where one side was widescreen and one side is pan and scan.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you never knew which side was which, because it didn't really say which was in, like, it's like, yeah. Is widescreen the part that goes down, or is it the other side?
Or the side
is
it goes up. Yeah.
Side that goes up.
I love that people listening to this podcast right now are just like, phone booths, video stores, DVDs that have widescreen on one side and pan and scan on the other.
It's our dead tech episode. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that, I mean, listen, this movie's a misfire. I want to hit a couple other things really quick in the plot. But like, Walt's buddies pay for a dancer / prostitute to come over to his place to sleep with him. That scene made me really sad. it's a really sad scene. And despite the fact that I agree with you, Kenny, that De Niro is sort of hamstrung by the physicalness of it, that scene, he's very good in that scene, and it's a sad scene. But then we get our fucking gay Republicans, which is stupid. Oh, here's the part that I loved. The surprise party that they throw for Walt, and one of the drag queens has cufflinks that shoot BBs?
Yeah, Wilson Heredia. Yeah.
But, why? And it's the sort of thing where, like, there's so many moments in the movie, like, with Roy Cochran playing guitar, where you're like, this is going to come back, right? Where it's like, the gun cufflinks, where you're like, oh, that's going to be important, and it just isn't. And you're like, what was the point of the gun cufflinks?
Those are Chekhov's cufflinks.
They were just, like, left over from Batman and Robin, and he was like,
Yeah,
I do agree that, like, I think Matt, you made this point earlier. That party's really kind of an endearing moment for all the characters.
It was like the best part of the movie because then it's like the hot pizza guy from downstairs comes up and they take his shirt off and you're like, yes, this is great.
It's just, and he wanted to be there, and then his Uncle Tony shows up and pulls him out.
And pulls him downstairs. Hey, like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be
there. To deliver. Comforting with drag queens.
And it's also great because, like, you know, angry uncle is not yelling at gay people. He's just like, get back downstairs, you knucklehead. Leave these nice ladies alone.
It's a nut. That really was what the movie could have been.
That's the tone they should have been going for the whole time.
It's not that hard. No. And I hated this movie. There were no revelations. De Niro had this black physical therapist who served no purpose but to be the foil for a few racist jokes. Yep. That character could have played into it a little more. There's just all these pieces that in any of our screenplays, because we're all tremendous writers, we would have consolidated it and worked it in such a way that these characters affected each other and affected the story. And
it needed to be streamlined. It needed to be sharpened. Like it felt, as we've said before, but we'll say it again, like it felt like a first draft. It felt like someone hadn't told him to do another pass. I'm just like, this isn't ready yet. It's just, it's half baked.
Like,
I'll say this. There is a nice scene where at this point we've got Walter. What's up?
I said, like The Departed.
Yeah. So
there is like The Departed, scene. Right?
What's that?
Yeah. Kenny loves The Departed.
This movie's a lot like The Departed. Yeah.
I think it's just like The Departed in that they're both just the fucking worst.
We do have a scene where Walter and Rusty are talking, and Walter confesses that he has all this money stashed away. I don't particularly love him stashing the money away, but I don't hate the fact that Walt is upset because Rusty used him as a cover. That was a nice emotional turn. Probably the only good one in the movie, but like, it's a moment where Walt's insecurities come to light in a way that is somewhat interesting. Even if I think that basically from this point on, it's clunky as a motherfucker. It doesn't really make any sense. The money, the people, all this shit. Walt straight up murders a guy, shoots him in the head. It gets fucking crazy. Not in a fun way. Very, very low on hijinks. Very high on not
low
fun.
Jinx.
Low jinx.
So many low jinx in this movie.
Should have renamed this movie Flawedness.
I liked Flawful.
Flawful.
I also have to say too that I think that the last scene of this film in the ambulance is supposed to be endearing, but it is not. Mm. Which is, Walt gets shot in the shoulder, gets shot in the shoulder. He's in the ambulance. The paramedic says that Rusty can't come in, but Walter says he's my sister or she's my sister or whatever.
However, no, he says he's my sister, misgendering her.
Exactly. Then she gets into the ambulance, and rather than using the money for a sex reassignment, she decides to use the money to get a bullet out of his shoulder, which, spoiler, a lot less money, just for what it's worth. And then the last line of this film, I think, is literally Walt turning to Rusty and saying, thank God you didn't cut your dick and balls off yet.
I had assumed, and I mean,
space?
Just even ignoring that line because it's awful, but I had assumed that it was only part of the money. It wasn't all of it.
Well, he hands him a sweaty wad of cash from his. Yeah. I don't know how much it is.
A sweaty wad of cash.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's in her corset. I feel like it's definitely it's getting all that sweat.
There is,
as a sweaty person myself, I can relate.
I already took my sweatshirt off. I'm sweating so hard right now.
I see that
Peloton behind you. We should be Peloton friends.
Oh, we should. It's my favorite thing.
I know, it's the best. It's.
I was thinking about getting one.
It's everything. It's worth it. It's like there's
literally use it every day because I'm trash.
Yeah, me too. I'm forky.
Yeah, it's a bad scene that I think they think is kind of like a what. Like, I think they think it's like, these guys, they're so crazy and kooky. They love each other. It's all going to be fine. And I it's crazy. And then they sing that song over the entire fucking credits.
Yeah, it's
did you watch?
Like, is this going to go anywhere? Or is this just them singing the song over again? And it is. Singing the song over again, and it's bad.
It's bad. It's terrible.
That line and this whole movie is a relic of a time when being lambasted for your race, religion, gender identity, sexual identity, anything, was just part of your admission into patriarchal culture.
Sure.
Right? So like the last line is like, now I like you so I can make fun of the fact that you're trans, because why would you, you know, I like you.
We're friends now.
And I think what's been made very clear over the last, you know, 20 years or whatever since this movie came out is no. That is re-traumatization. And that is the kind of shit you have to drop when you respect people. So I think that's like that, by the way, that's also something Green Book does in spades. So I think that that's the kind of thing that like will forever kind of stick with me with this movie, which is like, as long as you're willing, if you're a marginalized person, as long as you're willing to be marginalized, you know, publicly and take it, you know, take it like a man, you can hang out with me. That's cool. So
yeah,
it's pretty horrible stuff.
Just hated it. I hated it so much.
It's awful. So Kenny, should we talk? We're going to do our top five Joel Schumacher movies. I know that Matt, you don't know if you were able to put five together or,
I mean, I can talk about a couple movies that I really liked of this.
Yeah. Let's do that. Which ones do you like?
But Matt, part of it was that like, there's a very good chance that he didn't make five good movies. Just have to say the five least worst.
I mean, honestly, I think my favorite is just Lost Boys, because even as like, you know, it is so gay, because the entire movie is just about like these, like this boy wanting to be friends with these other boys who like hang out in this cave. And I'm like, yes, that is my vibe. Yeah. Like, absolutely. Like, I want to hang out with Kiefer Sutherland in a weird earring and like ride around on motorcycles and go to a carnival all night. That sounds fucking great. And then they'll do sex stuff. Like, that sounds awesome.
I might watch that movie tonight.
It's a great movie.
It's a really good movie. And there's like sexy sax man. Like, there's so many parts of that movie that are just like so gay.
It also to me is one of probably like 10 like iconic 80s films, like a film that I just associate with the 80s. And I don't know if it's because some of my favorite movies always seem to have a marquee where the Lost Boys is playing, or like the poster just feels so iconic to me. It's such a fucking good poster. The poster or the movie?
A movie.
Oh, wow. Wait, I think you'll really like it, Kenny.
Sorry. Okay. You should watch it.
So embarrassed.
And
I think I've seen every relevant Joel Schumacher movie aside from that and Tigerland. But
I will say The Lost Boys also has one of the best last lines in a movie ever.
I was going to say it, and I'm glad you said you hadn't seen it, because now I'm not going to say it. Yeah. Because it is just like, it is such a fun movie.
I could not watch it with my kids.
No.
We watched.
How old are they?
They're young. We watched Teen Wolf last night.
Oh, maybe then.
I think, yeah. Well, Lost Boys is a little more,
it's a little darker.
Teen Wolf,
a little racist.
Although Teen Wolf does have that scene where that extra shows their penis, so you know.
Huh?
It's like one of the most famous gaffes of all time. In Teen Wolf, in the last basketball scene, one of the extras pulls their pants out and shows their penis.
Oh, Jesus.
Wow.
All right. We survived.
Yeah.
The thing about Teen Wolf is that movie takes place during the day, and The Lost Boys is all like, it's all night gothic. It's spookier. I don't know that it'll play as well.
It won't. I'm not going to watch Lost Boys with them. I'll just sit and watch it alone.
But I think you'll love it, and I do think that the last line will be one of your favorite last lines, Kenny.
All right, cool.
What other movies of his, Matt, do you like?
I mean, I'm looking at the list right now. I mean, obviously, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin are just so ingrained in my mind together as one movie.
Sure.
Like, it's hard for me to say. Like, I think Batman Forever is Two-Face, and then Batman and Robin is Ice, Iceman, right? Yeah. Iceman and Poison Ivy?
Dr. Freeze, I think, is what you mean.
Iceman. Iceman is X-Men. Never mind. But Iceman is also gay, by the way, and X-Men. Freeze.
Is it Dr. Freeze?
Mr. Freeze?
Oh, sorry. I gave him a PhD. I shouldn't have given him.
Clearly a doctor.
The Honorable Dr. Freeze.
If he doesn't have a doctorate, none of us need doctorates.
Yeah.
The PhDs are shit because this guy.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I feel like I saw Flatliners a long time ago, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's on my list. Kenny, do you want to walk through your five and we can do this?
I'm just writing this right now.
Dr.
I mean, I will also say Falling Down, I kind of enjoyed. It was like one of those like things that when I was a kid, like, oh, this movie's on. This guy's angry. Uh-oh.
Yeah, that sums it up.
That was very.
That was the tagline of the movie, I think.
Yeah, I think it was.
All right,
this guy's angry.
I'll give you my five.
What's your number five? What's your five?
Number five, Batman Forever, movie I hate. No, I think Batman Forever is fun. I think Batman Forever has some good shit. I think it has some really, really bad shit. And I think there are some.
Well, I love it.
But I don't like Tommy Lee Jones at all. Like, I think his performance is the worst, but everything else about it I kind of like, and I like how stupid it is. I like the way Batman figures it out. Like, he figures it out that, you know, it's like one big mystery wrapped inside of a riddle, wrapped inside of a enigma. So it's such a stupid movie, but I also really do love the Chase Meridian in like hanging from one thing and Robin hanging from the other thing and Batman having to save both. And I think the score is fantastic. And I think the imagery is fantastic. So, and I really think the bat nipples are really kind of important to this movie. I think it's important. I think it's important to hint and highlight at the campiness and kind of the inherent gayness of superheroes. Take the fucking piss out of all these fanboys a little bit. You are watching grown-ups dress up and fight crime, like have a little more fucking fun with it.
It was a cultural reset. It was an important moment.
Cultural reset.
I have Batman Forever is a little higher on my list. And I'll say that I was perhaps never more excited to see a movie than I was to see Batman Forever. I mean, I literally wanted the teaser poster for the Riddler so badly that my mom almost... I can't believe I'm saying this, that my mom almost broke into a bus shelter to get one out of it for me, which is very kind of her. She almost loved it. ultimately, I got the poster through other means, but I truly don't think I had been ever more excited to see a movie than that film. And at the time, loved every minute of it. I watched it again the other day on HBO Max. It's a silly movie, but... I kind of dig it. There's some good stuff in it. And Jim Carrey is like at his most Jim Carrey. But anyway.
It is the pinnacle of Jim Carrey. It feels like.
Phil, that's the poster with the question mark around the bat symbol.
The teaser poster, the character poster for the Riddler, like the one of his.
Riddle me this, riddle me that.
There was a shot. And it's a pretty iconic shot at this point. But when I saw it in the trailer, of the question mark around the bat signal, and the bat signal being the period at the bottom of the question mark, I thought that was the most powerful filmic image I had ever seen. And there was something about that where I'm like, holy shit, Batman is in trouble. He's coming after the bat signal. If he takes out the bat signal, what do we have left? I quite like that movie. And I also love, I think Dr. Chase Meridian is such a good character name.
It's one of the best.
Yeah. I mean, now I feel like we know.
She's chasing that line, man. She's chasing that line between Batman and Bruce Wayne.
And the Bruce.
My number five is The Client, which I don't know. I'm a sucker for a John Grisham movie, and I thought, you know, I put The Client in A Time to Kill at five, basically. Like, I think the Schumacher's version of those John Grisham books is pretty solid. What's your number four, Kenny?
A Time to Kill.
Oh, there you go. Great.
I like these movies. I'll always
yeah. They're
like
good movies. They're solid movies. My number four is Falling Down. I had a very similar experience to you, Matt, which is I remember watching it with friends. I think that came out. When did it come out? Like 94 or something like that. 93, 94. And just thinking to myself, like, this movie is fucking edgy. This guy's really angry. This guy's uh-oh. Not like I don't know what this guy's gonna do. And like, it kind of was the proto Fincher, kind of like there's a little bit of Fincher in there of like someone who's railing against, you know, the anti-establishmentarianism of it. Like it has a little proto Fight Club in it, which I think is interesting.
What's your number three, St. Elmo's Fire.
Never seen it.
Like I said, Schumacher doesn't make great movies. It's not a great movie, but it's like super watchable. I really love those actors, like to an actor. I find a lot of comfort in watching Judd Nelson and Emilio and Ally Sheedy and Demi Moore and Rob Lowe and who's the last one? And Mare Whittingham. I think that like and Andy McDowell's in it. There's something they try to do that movies don't ever really get, which is that like year or first couple years out of college that now people always, you know, put in parents' basements or make them like dumb stoners, or it's just a very lame kind of arrested development situation. But like, I liked that these people were all trying to get their shit together and how hard it is when you're trying to get your shit together in earnest. And I think St. Elmo's Fire is an awesome song.
I don't hate
who did the song.
Who did the song? Cyndi Lauper?
Like Peter Cetera. No, it's a man. But it's like Peter Cetera or something.
St. Elmo's Fire, I think, is a good movie. I think it does all the things you're talking about, Kenny. I think that it's a little bit of a relic of a different time.
For sure.
Which is that it was actually on TV the other day and I caught the end of it. There's this moment at the end where Emilio Estevez, without consent, kisses Andy McDowell at the end of the movie.
Yeah. And that's his big arc that he's going to kiss.
And the music crescendos and he drives away thinking he's the cock of the walk. And I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? But all that being said,
John Parr is the singer's name. The great John Parr.
All right.
My number three is Batman Forever. We already talked about that. What's your number two, Kenny?
The Client. We already talked about it. But I actually love two. I love this movie. I've seen it so many times. I just think it's a great movie. So well. Brad Renfro, so fucking good in this movie.
Yeah. My number two is Lost Boys. What's your number one, Kenny?
Falling Down. The only movie I think he's done that's actually great and so fucking relevant to right now. Like, all these motherfuckers
not wearing
masks and all these people, it is white male rage over the littlest nothings that caused the biggest fucking problems that people took the wrong message from. I always looked at Schumacher's filmography, again, having never seen Tigerland, which people say is great, and thought, he also made this? Like, because I think it's truly great.
My number one is Flatliners. I love Flatliners. I think it's one of those movies that
I think Flatliners a lot too.
It's got such a cool idea. I fucking love the idea of dying and bringing people back and like what that space in between life and death is. I think it's a great fucking poster too. Like, it's also like Flatliners and Lost Boys is when I think Schumacher is at his visual best. Like, just amazing production design, like great lighting. He understands the visual motifs that he wants to play with, and he's just really cooking with gas. And then he makes Batman movies and it all turns into whatever. But those two films, Flatliners and Lost Boys, I think are him at his best.
This, I actually wish I put Flatliners on my list, because this is why I like Flatliners. Flatliners is a drug movie that actually makes drugs look appealing. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a good way. I mean, like, it actually gives you a bit of the rush that you get, and people don't necessarily know that the crash is going to happen. So it's whatever you watch, Trainspotting or whatever, and that love Trainspotting, all that shit, but you know that the crash is going to happen, and that's a big arc of that movie. Doing drugs is about getting closer to death. It is about tempting death. They literalize that movie and make it very exciting, and I think it's a very, very great idea and a pretty cool movie too.
Yeah, and it also gave us one of the best lines in Popstar. I don't know if you guys have seen Popstar.
I love that movie.
the Bill Hader moment of flatlining during concerts and him saying, "Did I piss myself again?"
I could talk about Popstar literally all day long.
It's fantastic. Like, it's
great. It is criminally underrated, and I think it should have made $100 million in its opening weekend. Like, not even exaggerating. I think it's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen in my life.
I feel that way. Insane. I feel that way about MacGruber.
Also fantastic.
Again, but the same people. They keep making these great movies, and no one is going to see them. Weird. It's a problem.
Yeah. It's weird. So Matt, let's rate Flawless. What from 0 to 99? What's your rating for this film before the podcast and then after the podcast?
So like what I thought it was going to be. I hadn't seen it before.
No, not what you thought it was going to be. What it was when you came on the podcast and what it is now, because we obviously changed your opinion for better or worse.
So coming into the podcast, I would probably say it was 10 tens, tens across the board.
Woo!
10 out of 99.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
And then now after talking about it, it's probably, let's see, a straight up zero. Like, I mean, one maybe? That's because there's like
That's a cold maybe shower, like, right there. Yeah.
I am, pray tell in pose, telling this movie off.
Damn. Phil.
That's icy. I'm not as low as you, but I mean, it's this is not a good movie. I before we sat down for the podcast, I had it at a 38. and after this conversation, I'm at a 25. It's not a good movie, but it's, you know, as I said up top, I think it's got the best of intentions. I would never recommend anybody watch this film, but if they did watch this film, I think they'd probably find something redeeming about Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance and perhaps some of the things it has to say about, I don't know, human contact.
Oh, remember that?
No.
I forgot to ask Matt what he's watching during the pandemic. We'll do it next time you're on.
We'll do
I had it at 34. I thought it was pretty, you know, horrible, but not like fucking zero horrible. After the podcast, I am going to drop it down quite a bit. I'm going to go exactly where you went, Phil. 25.
Yeah.
It's not that I think anything is particularly good about it. And I do think it's offensive, and I do think it's dangerous. But I wasn't super bored. And there is something to be said for it was marginally watchable.
Yeah.
And some of the movies we've done are so mind-numbingly boring that I do have to give some points to a movie that, like, I didn't, you know, watch on my phone the entire time. So watch while scrolling, I mean. So so there you go, 25.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is not a good movie. I'm not under any, you know, I don't think it's a good movie, but we covered it. I'm glad I watched it on some level, you know.
It exists.
Mm-hmm. R.I.P. Joel Schumacher.
I was just going to say R.I.P. Joel Schumacher.
He gave us some
really cool stuff. He took some swings and I respect him for the swings, but he
gave us a great article within the last 18 months. He's a cool dude.
His article about how many people he's had sex with is just
10,000, like, right?
Yeah. I think it was 8 women and 10,000 men. Yeah. I thought it was great.
It's just like, it was amazing. There's also, I don't know if either of you follow Matthew Libatique on Instagram by any chance, but he's worth following. And he shot the number 23, the infamous Jim Carrey, Joel Schumacher movie where he's obsessed with the number 23 and he goes crazy. Anyway, all that being said, Matthew Libatique
didn't make any of our list. Weird.
Yeah. Matty Libatique had a little post after Joel Schumacher passed away about just what it was like working with him. And he sounds like a guy that you wish that I bet we would have had a blast making a movie with Joel Schumacher. So for what that's worth, thank you for being here, Matt. We really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
And we hope that you'll come back soon for something else in the future.
Yeah. Thank you for coming. I mean, at this point, how many movies do you have left?
Oh, God. Hundreds. We still have like 150 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We're still going to have that. And we also, we absolutely love to have you back. Next week, we're doing The Limey with David Sims.
Ooh.
Do you have thoughts on The Limey or Steven Soderbergh by any chance that you'd like to share with us?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, I actually like The Limey a lot. I saw it when I was in college and I thought it was a fun movie. And I love Soderbergh. Even though Contagion gave me my first panic attack in the movie theater.
Yeah. That's why I've never watched it. That's why I'll never watch it.
It's terrifying.
You can watch it now. Movie, you're fucking living it. So
yeah, but it's like everything that I'm having a panic attack or had a panic attack over is like, oh cool. This is life now.
Yeah.
Which is also like great movie. You made me feel something.
Yeah. I think Soderbergh's a genius.
The best.
He's the best. I can't wait to talk about him. It's going to be a blast.
When are you guys doing Logan Lucky?
That wasn't a 99 movie.
We'll be partying like it's 2017.
Yeah.
Fucking Logan Lucky is, oh my God. Ugh.
It's really great. What is your favorite Soderbergh movie? Filmmakers.
Matt, because I know that, I know that we'll do ours next week, but what's your favorite, Matt?
I mean, honestly, like looking at the list of his movies right now, I mean, I might even say it might be Logan Lucky because I thought was one of the funniest movies I'd seen in a long time. But like, it's that and like Ocean's 11, you know, Magic Mike. I love those movies. But like, Logan Lucky was just so fun and just so ridiculous. And just like, I really love the characters so much. Like, it was such a great time. And also, as someone who like grew up with NASCAR and like going to NASCAR races in Georgia. Like it's like it felt like he was onto something with like a heist movie at a racetrack.
Yeah,
it's like cool.
I think that he's one of those filmmakers that I honestly believe every film or television show that he does, you can palpably feel how much he loves making movies.
Yeah,
and that how much he has such pure joy in the making of it. And Logan Lucky to me is one of those films that. It just radiates off the screen that everyone is having the time of their lives making this thing.
Yeah.
Matt, I probably reference Magic Mike in pitches more than any other movie. There's just there
so
that
fun.
Movie is a fucking it's a Swiss watch. Like it's
so good.
And I know and then there are some things that it deviates from classic structure. That I love too. Like I'm so taken by the fact that Alex Pettifer is your protagonist going into the movie and winds up becoming your villain. Like what a great like structural turn. I absolutely love that movie. I absolutely love Soderbergh. I think like it's a pretty good case that he's the best filmmaker of the last 20 years.
So. And it's so funny too because Magic Mike XXL is also. I know he didn't direct it, but I think he DP'd it. And it's also like you can tell that he still loves that world, and even if he's not directing it, he's still involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because also Magic Mike XXL has one of my favorite scenes, like in cinema, of just like fucking Joe Manganiello like pouring water on himself at the gas station, which is like, what is this art? Like,
what is this art?
Like mise-en-scène. Like, I just love it.
Yeah,
I think there's something. I mean, you guys both know about Alex Pettifer's tattoo that he has on his pelvis.
No,
he has a tattoo.
I actually don't.
He has a tattoo like right above his dick that says "You're welcome."
That's cool. That's just cool.
So, I love it.
Knowing that he has to be your villain is the way I see it.
Oh no, that's awesome. That's like that's
it
insane.
Is decidedly not awesome.
It is so cool. I can't even. No.
That's like I like this is like a maybe a too much information of a personal story, but it's like I hooked up with a guy like decade ago, uh-huh. And he had the worst tattoos I'd ever seen, which was like I think he had like honestly had like a Monster Energy drink tattoo.
Stop
but then God.
He, but then he had like a tramp stamp, which was his initials.
In case you forgot,
and it was just like But it was just like, in case people forget who they're with,
don't
like, what is this?
The wrong
like,
name? It's right there.
It was just so weird. It's so weird. Like, what is this?
That's amazing. It's like he was giving you clues.
Yeah, just like, just in case you forget, the initials are on the back.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
Well,
that was great. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming on. Yes. We really appreciate it. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.